I apologise in advance. What I say is going to be fairly unstructured, because basically I'm just filling gaps, complimenting what my colleagues were saying, and I haven't heard what they had to say, so I'm literally going to improvise based on the information I've got and the ideas that come up. So I think we've more or less covered the Goblin Shaft, and it's true that it is a good point that you made, that we learned how to read these scripts with very intensive practice, but there wasn't a specific history of scripts course. And that is something in the UK we have and we don't have. It depends. On the UCL course, for example, we focus a lot on practical reading, but we try and introduce a little bit of history of scripts. So I actually do work in a chronological way. It was interesting to hear Ernie was saying, because they started with humanist, because that's easiest. Well, I start with Carolingian, because, well, you know, there's not much difference. And conveniently, it does become, well, you know what I mean. Humanist is a copy of Carolingian. And so we do work, so I do try and introduce a bit of history of scripts as I go. And in fact, this year there was an innovation, an excellent course co-taught by Julia Crick and David Dabray here in this room, a set of lectures between Kings and UCL on history of scripts, and then complemented by other lectures such as textual criticism taught by Daniel Haddas and other people. And that has given the students a framework in history of scripts, something that we didn't have before in UCL as such, as in a structured way. And I think actually it works very well to complement, to give the students an idea of how scripts evolved over time and their changes, as well as learning to read them. But of course, you can argue that for an Archimedes paleograph, the main point is to know how to decipher the script. And of course, as we all know, there's lots of debates as to how to name scripts. I mean, you've made allusion to it. And, I mean, the book of Desrolles, for example, on naming the scripts does not make unanimity when it comes to naming Gothic scripts. Before that, we had Liefting to try, and some people would say, well, does it matter what you call it, as long as you know how to read it? On the other hand, you could say, well, if you're describing a manuscript, and of course that's the other aspect, the codicology aspect, you do need some way of being able to identify what the script is like. Another point about history of scripts, of course, is how far back do you go? And you mentioned, you know, we were not taught Merovingian in the École des Chartes. I mean, I think one saw a few facsimiles of Merovingian to get an idea of the horrors of Merovingian script, but you didn't actually learn to read them. And certainly that's what I was taught in UCL in another department, the Department of Greek and Latin, where they had a Latin paleography course, which is one that I teach now, where we start from the Roman cursives and the Roman capitals onwards. But when we reach Merovingian cursives, in fact, New Roman cursives, we don't expect the students to be able to read it. We teach it because it's part of the history of script, the evolution of script, and it's important to understand how later scripts derive from these monstrosities. But let's face it, some other long-suffering scholars have deciphered most of what is survived in those scripts, and it is better to let students focus on scripts where there's plenty of unedited material waiting to be deciphered, which is Carolingian onwards. So that is a pragmatic view of, which I think is shared. I mean, as far as I know, nobody in England teaches Merovingian script in terms of how to read it. And in fact, this year I'm actually going to give a one-day course at the London Summer School of Paleography on Merovingian book counts, just because there's been some demand from students that, you know, we'd like to learn a bit about it, but I'm not going to inflict Merovingian cursive on them. I will show a few pictures of them so that they can blench, but we will concentrate on the book counts. But even then, that's more for people's interest than for practical use nowadays, until such time as miraculously new texts appear that need deciphering. New Roman cursive is actually still a useful skill because, as we know, the Bloomberg tablets were discovered recently. I've heard of the wooden tablets that were discovered in central London when they were excavating. And so, but even then, Roger Tomlin probably did most of the work on his own, because you have a few, very few experts in those fields. And I suppose a general point is, you know, are we going to have a fairly pragmatic view? If there's limited time and resources to study paleography, what do we focus on? Question marks of the date as well. So that was that. What else? Fidem, you wanted me to. I mean, all I can say is, I mean, Mark Smith mentioned Fidem to me. It sounds quite a very interesting course, actually. It's for the Diplôme Européen d'Études Médiévales, DEEM. It takes a place in Rome, and as Mark put it, he says it's equivalent to doing the École des Chartes course, but in one concentrated block, so to speak. And they cover Latin, paleography, codicology, diplomatic, textual editing, and history of libraries. And it attracts a very very much an international audience, in particular students from Scandinavian countries, and Romania in particular, we go to that, countries where presumably the offering in Latin, in paleography is probably fairly limited, if not non-existent. And of course, summer schools are often a way for training people. I mean, it's interesting to say that the London summer school, we've now actually added the word international, so it's now London International Paleography Summer School. And that was partly actually because we do have a significant amount of our students are international. I mean, people from Australia have come, as well as a few Americans, Germans, Italians, you know, because of the lack of offering in their own country. So interesting enough, and of course the US also have some international summer schools which are quite popular. I mean, they've got the Rare Book Schools, one in the Bionica, and one in Virginia, which of course now we compete with because we've got a London Rare Book School as well. And the Mellon Foundation organises summer institutes in vernacular paleography, again something that's perhaps not taught enough in the countries concerned sometimes. So the Newbury have it in French, English, Italian, Spanish. They alternate in different, they do two languages every year. And then there's even a scientific project which is taking one particular scientific manuscript, and every year they're deciphering bits of it. It's actually a book of art recipes, how to make different art materials. And so the students come along, Mark Smith comes along, and they all work hard at deciphering these things. So it's like an intensive course in deciphering for the students. And then actually the organizer of this, Pamela Smith, who's a science historian, they go to the lab and they try out the recipes that they've just been deciphering. Which so a hands-on experience in paleography and then in actual applying the results, which sounds fascinating. So because even in America there's relatively few places that teach paleography on a regular basis. I mean, there's the Notre Dame where David Gantz teaches. There's New Mexico, but other than that, it's relatively limited there too. So a lot of places you tend to find that some schools are becoming more the way to learn things. And even Germany, I was told, no longer has as much paleography teaching as it used to. And therefore, and I see someone nodding in sad agreement there in the back of the room. So apparently there too, summer schools are starting to take over. There's one called Scripto, based in Erlangen, which is very much linked to medieval Latin philology. And that's another point to make generally, is the links, you know, where do you link paleography? Do you link it with history? Do you link it with philology? In fact, in France and Italy, you often find it's either linked, or it can be linked with either or both philology and history. And going back to France for a moment, for example, when we were talking about Bourbons, the Paris Quatre course, as I mentioned very briefly, is linked with Romance philology, as in it's aimed at at students of medieval French literature, literature in medieval French. So they are teaching a vernacular bookhand, whereas if you don't do vernacular bookhand at all at the École des Chartes, you have French, but in the context of documents. So there is a link, and of course here we, you know, Daniel talking about English faculty. So there you are sort of linking hagiography, reading documents, but actually reading books in English because you're studying it as a historian of the language. And in UCL, our English department too has paleography classes and history of the book classes, often in the context of an MA in medieval English, which often links up with the MA in medieval studies that I co-teach with David, which is where we have students who are mainly historians, but some of them are literary people as well, and they have a choice about taking options as well from the MA English. So we have basically historians and philologists all interested in paleography as a practical subject. I gather that in Spain, and we've got Ainhoa, who's an expert from Spain, can complement anything I have to say, is that a lot of the teaching is actually often in the context of archives and reading documents more than books, but you can complement me. This is information that I have. You have lots of local paleography centres based more on looking at studying the documents, the archives of that place. But,
not really. I think it's more like the intermediate people. History, philology, classics, archaeology together. They all
okay.
have paleography as a mandatory course. Also archival sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big group. And it's mm-hmm. mandatory for all undergraduates of these degrees.
That's good. Yeah,
yeah, there's many. Yeah. We don't have, as you have, summer school. We have one summer school, but it's not really big. And we don't have institutes as a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And we only have maybe three or four universities where you can pursue an MA or a PhD on photography.
Sabine, Valencia.
Salamanca, no longer. So you have Valladolid, Barcelona, Madrid, and Seville. So that would be more or less.
Mm. Great, thank you very much, Aino. Sorry to spring that on you, but as you're in the room, it'd be nice to have a. But interesting that you said it's mandatory for undergraduates. I don't know how much in the UK you would find mandatory or even optional undergraduate courses in paleography. You mentioned that some of your undergraduates, but it depends a bit on who's teaching.
They have to be taking a specific form of the English degree, even to have the option of taking it.
Yeah, and in UCL, as far as I know, our history undergraduates don't have access to paleography. In the Greek and Latin department, actually, I do teach a Latin paleography course and a medieval Latin course, and that's very rare. That we do it. I mean, I did my degree in classics in Cambridge, and a bit like you were saying, I thought of text. I mean, I never even thought about where text came from. You'd be struggling through Thucydides or Cicero or whatever, and you might be using an edition that had all these mysterious footnotes with all these sigla and things like that, but you ignored them as an undergraduate. You were struggling with the language, you weren't worried about textual transmission. And if someone had said to me, where does Cicero come from, I would have. I'll just scratch my head and say, well, I don't know, perhaps somehow, some books from, the ancient world was buried somewhere and an archaeological person dug them out. I didn't even know what a classical book looked like, that they were papyrus scrolls rather than, one wasn't encouraged to think about it. I mean, I hope things have actually changed. I think, people like Tessa Weller around, I'm hoping that there is some more awareness now in the classics faculty of what how books actually reached us, how the classics reached us. But I suspect in most universities, both in France and in England, that most undergraduates are blissfully unaware of the actual transmission of their texts. And you were mentioning the École Normale Supérieure that trains future teachers and in fact universities. And as you say, they prepare the cabinets and the agrégation, which are the main competitive exams, the concours that in France you have to take in order to teach. And yes, they probably are just doing anything to do with textual editing or whatever. But even then, when you're teaching a secondary school kids, which is what most of these people are going to do, you don't need to. You don't need paleography. And therefore, there's this utilitarian way, you're going to teach what is relevant for the exam. Never mind the general culture of the students. So that, unfortunately, I suspect is similar in both countries. And I suppose the question we can ask ourselves is it something that we would want to try and disseminate more at undergraduate level as well. Perhaps even something for this afternoon session, talking about dissemination and teaching of paleography. The only other main thing that something that just occurred to me when you were talking, Daniel, was when you're talking about qualitative and quantitative paleography. I think that is actually quite an interesting field that they are doing in France quite a lot. Gabriel Gilbert Houy did a lot on quantitative work to do with history of book in particular, methods of reading, and I think there is quite a little following now on quantitative analysis of things, and also in terms of scripts, and of course that is coming, I think, in the UK a bit. I think some of the digital work and everything, where you're analysing, how many times a particular shape comes up or whatever. I think in France in particular, I think quantitative and statistical methods are being used more than possibly in the UK in terms of research to do with paleography or history of the book or manuscript studies. And that's actually a last point I will make, is that often in English, when we use the word paleography, we often mean actually as a general term covering manuscript studies. But Mark Smith did point out to me that in France, when you talk about paleography, you mean very much history and deciphering of scripts and nothing else. Whereas in England, we tend to often use it as a more in Britain as a more general term, including codicology. We can sometimes use it as a more generic term covering codicology and history of scripts or studying manuscripts generally. I think that's probably enough from me. Sorry to say it's hopping from around different subjects, but hopefully it's given us all now enough material to start discussing and thinking about things. Thank you.